Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. It's Wednesday, the 30th of March 2022, and I can hardly believe we're nearly into the second quarter of the year, Phil. The year seems to be shooting past at a terrifying rate. Or am I just slowing down?
No, it's the opposite. It's because you're busy. Yeah. Time flies when you're busy, David, which is all good.
People have been busy this past week, I guess. We're going to look at some of the news that has emerged over the last 7 days or so. And I suppose the first thing that we should mention is the thing which we couldn't mention last week because we were actually recording before Rishi Sunak got up and started talking in the House of Commons. But it's his spring statement. That was the big event of last week.
Yes, well, it was supposed to be the big event. I was somewhat underwhelmed. I think the general media comments that I've been seeing suggest that some of the sheen and the shine yes. might be wearing off Dishy Rishi. Yes, this is the man who'd thrown how many billions of pounds at the economy to get us through COVID with all our furlough money and one thing and another. And now we're paying for it. I mean, some suggestion that there might be a little bit of gravy up his sleeve that'll pull out nearer the next election.
Yeah.
Make us, you know, more warmly inclined to him. But last week, not a lot. I suppose the headline for the construction industry is the something he did and something he didn't, was a little bit of tax reduction, or VAT removal on energy-saving materials. Mm-hmm. So if you can afford, you know, 20 grand for a ground source heat pump, if you're that rich, you'll get a little bit of money off.
Yeah.
But on the whole, it's marginal. I think most of these energy-saving materials, the prices of building materials and building components are going up anyway with product inflation and everything else. So I think these products will still be more expensive now than they were a year or two ago.
Yeah, and saving the planet is something which is only really available to people with a reasonable income. I mean, if you're on benefits or you're living in a tower block, there's not much you can do to add solar panels or wind turbines to your property, is there? It's you can't pat yourself on the back for saving the planet because you simply don't earn enough.
Well, we've talked before about the aged piles that you and I live in.
Yeah.
And it would, you know, I've calculated in rough terms that in order to get the investment required to make meaningful reduction on my energy bills, it's got something like a 30-year payback, and I don't think I'm going to be around that long.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there was that. There are a few small gestures, but they were small, weren't they? I mean, income tax has been cut by something like 1%, isn't it? Something like
not 1%. Yet, not yet,
or will be. Yes,
that's a couple of years away.
Yeah,
and these things change. So whether that will happen in a couple of years' time or not, who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I mean, that's nice. But and the national insurance threshold has gone up, so you get to keep more of your money before you start paying national insurance. But of course, the actual rate of national insurance, as previously announced, is also going up. So
smoke and mirrors.
The point's been made that you only pay national insurance if you work. You pay income tax on whatever you earn. So if you're, a loaded non-worker who rakes in money from stocks and shares and second, third, fourth, fifth homes which you rent out, you'll pay less income tax. We'll all pay less income tax, but only those people who are wage slaves will pay the more national insurance.
Yeah.
So it's not terribly progressive. What's going on at the moment with the tax situation in this country?
As usual, there was a healthy response. I say healthy. I'm talking in terms of volume response from people in the industry. I had over 30 emails that day, just from people commenting on what Rishi Sunak has said. But yeah, there's been a fairly lukewarm response from the industry to what he had to say.
Well, people who sell materials seem to like the fact that there's going to be less tax on some of those, or no tax, yeah, on VAT on some of those for a period of time. I mentioned the things that he did and the things that he didn't. The thing that he didn't, which has got drawn a lot of comment, is he said nothing about, there's no U-turn on the end of the red diesel rebate. Now, I don't think anyone really expected it, but there was a lot of squealing from the industry beforehand saying, can't go ahead with this. And the fact that it is going ahead, people are unsurprisingly upset, concerned, yeah, about the additional cost to the construction industry. There's a 5p duty, fuel duty has been cut by 5p.
Yes.
Allegedly. I haven't seen any forecourt I've driven past.
No.
But that 5p cut in fuel duty goes nowhere to the increased 43p in duty that construction's now going to have to pay by using standard white diesel.
Although, of course, we've had 2 years' notice that this was going to happen. So that should have been plenty of time for people to make arrangements in order to mitigate the impact of it. I mean, by arrangements, I mean basically find out how they're going to pass the cost on to their customers. But, you know, I heard a chap on the radio yesterday, I think it was, or might have been on Monday, from an SME contractor based up in Leeds somewhere, who was fairly sort of relaxed about it, in actual fact. He said, you know, we've had two years to prepare for this, and we've made the changes that we need to do, and we're ready. I don't think it's going to be really going to affect us very much. It was a bit of a non-story, I've got to say, because I was expecting him to say, you know, this is going to add massively to my costs and I'm going to lose money as a result of this. But the fact is that the end users, I mean, people like this contractor's clients, they're the people who will be picking up the tab in the end. And so you've just got to pass it on. And I think that's what the industry is going to do. And that's probably why, I mean, we've had some squealing, but I don't think the squealing is going to continue. People will just settle down and it'll be life as normal.
I think you're probably right, to be honest. But and it's not just fuel costs that are rising, of course. I mean, fuel costs are rising, even aside from the the move away, the loss of the red diesel rebate. Mm. And I was having a look at the... we also reported recently on the latest monthly survey of builders merchants.
Yeah.
They've been doing this for, I don't know, 5 or 10 years now. There's the Builders Merchant Federation produces something called the Builders Merchant Building Index.
Yeah.
Which I don't know whether they refer to it as Bimby or Bambi or Bombi, but anyway, the BMBI. And they've always measured activity at builders' merchants in this survey by the pound notes going through the till. And, in you know, month on month, sales go up and you tend to get, occasionally, you know, it might be a December or summer, Easter might dip down because there are fewer open shop trading days in those months. But essentially it always gets, you know, more and more sales for builders' merchants. But, of course, over the past 2 or 3 years, the price of these goods has gone up, and I've always gone back to these people and said, well, the income's going up, or the revenue I should say is going up, but are they actually selling any more product because of the product and inflation?
Yes.
And now they've started seem to be factoring that in. The report they put out last week was for the January sales, and they showed that in January 2022 sales were up 24% by value on January 2021, and 15% up on 2 years before, mm-hmm, even though there's two fewer trading days this year. But if you strip away the impact of inflation, there was not actually much growth in volume. Volume growth in the past 12 months, I suppose, is still healthy, 8%, but 15% price inflation.
Yeah.
And the growth since 2019... yes, there's been a 15% growth in volume, but that's all down to the fact that prices have gone up by 20%, and they've actually sold 4% less product in January this year than they did in January 2 years ago. So, you know, lies, damn lies and statistics. So the point I'm getting at is that 20% increase in prices in the past 2 years is quite substantial.
Yeah, yes, it certainly is. Yeah, so if you factor in the red diesel, the end of the red diesel rebate, I suppose it's just another straw on the camel's back, isn't it? And not the last straw, but just another one joining all the others. Screwing up my metaphors there.
It's same. It's the same for everyone, though. I mean, you made the point. It's a level playing field. Everyone's got those.
Yep.
Sorry, another metaphor. But it's the same for everyone. And as long as they, you know, charge their customers what their costs are, which, let's face it, builders do.
Yeah.
They're not going to go, yes, I'll build your extension. You can have the bricks for free, love. They don't do that. Not for me, anyway.
No.
So it's just, at the end of the day, it's the economy, it's the taxpayer that's going to bear the brunt of it. Inflation's going to go up.
Yeah.
I think the Rishi Sunak was reckoning it would be 8%, I think, towards the end of the year. I think it'll be higher. I think inflation is the big story.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that given all the sort of global factors that are sort of feeding into, you know, the current economic situation, inflation and all the rest of it, do you think there's anything that Rishi Sunak could have reasonably done that would have genuinely made people feel that he was tackling it? Or do you think that it was basically out of his hands, so he couldn't really do anything about it, given what he's already done for COVID?
I don't, to be honest. I don't think anyone could have squared the circle that's facing him. I know the Labour Party, Rachel Reeves, keeps talking about a windfall tax. And you see the profits that the energy companies are making, the big house builders are making, yeah. It's huge amounts of money. And you think, ooh, they're loaded. Why can't we have some of that? Why are the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer? But if you dump a windfall tax on these companies who are making hundreds of millions of pounds profit, all you're doing is reducing the income, corporation tax that you're going to take from them.
Yes.
It's going to come off their profits. So we want companies to make big money so that they pay big taxes.
And of course, a lot of the shareholders of these big energy companies are pension funds as well. And that obviously affects people's pensions.
Yes, absolutely. I think we had this conversation last week or the week before, didn't we? That it's, you know, we want big companies to make lots of money because we all benefit from it.
Yeah, as long as the board of directors don't trouser a lot of it and walk away like certain house builders have done in the past. But no, I mean, it's I think the windfall tax idea is a bit of a red herring as well. I don't think that that's necessarily going to benefit anybody.
But even if the directors do get a eight-figure bonus, £100 million bonus, they're still going to have to give something like 20, 30 million back to you and I in tax. Income tax
that's
on
true.
That, aren't
yeah.
they? So, you know, no more than that. Gosh, best part of 40 million they'd have to pay back unless they've got a crooked accountant.
Well, I'm sure they could afford one if they wanted one. Oh, well.
I mean crooked in the loosest sense.
Yeah, yes,
of not necessarily someone whose morals are crooked.
Well, anyway, so that's a rather lacklustre spring statement, and I think that nobody is popping open the champagne corks as a result of that, but we're just getting on with it, I suppose.
We're talking about the diesel costs going up, and we've talked before how a lot of people are switching to HVO, not because it saves them any money, because it's taxed at the same rate as regular diesel. Not only that, as I understand, it's about 20 pence a litre more expensive than regular diesel, whether you're paying, you know, whether you get your rebate on your HVO or you don't, because it's taxed at the same rate. Now, there's an interesting story that came out from Buckingham Group contracting, and I dare say this might be quite common, but I hadn't heard about it, so I thought it was worth reporting on. Buckingham Group Contracting, like many, many people, are increasing their use of hydrotreated vegetable oil, HVO, which reduces their carbon emissions and so on. And they've got a huge earth-moving job in Corby, Priors Hall Park, which is a massive residential development for urban and civic. It sounds like almost like one of these new town places.
Oh, right, okay.
Corby is itself a new town anyway, I think, isn't it? But I don't know how many, 5,000 plus new homes are going up over the coming years.
Oh, right, okay.
And Buckingham are now in their third season of earth moving. Anyway, point of the story is that their client, Urban and Civic, has agreed to go halves on the extra cost of HVO. Because Buckingham Group wants to do the right thing, wants to reduce it, it has targets to, you know, everyone wants to be net zero and all that.
Sure.
And I don't know how the conversation went, but Urban and Civic have said you want to spend more money on more expensive fuel, which is going to be cleaner. We'll share the burden with you. We'll get halves. And I thought that was quite interesting.
It is. Obviously, there's a lot of value attached to the sort of environmental dividend that you get from doing something like this. I mean, we're all being urged now to do what we can to save the environment, aren't we? And we have been for several years. But that's going above and beyond, I guess. Certainly nobody's required to do that.
It sounds like a hell of a job, actually. I mean, they've completed 3 million cubic metres of earthworks in the first three seasons. And this year, I'm sorry, in their fourth season now, they've done three seasons and moved 3 million cubic metres. And this year, another 1.5 million cubic metres. I can't even picture that.
No.
Normally, these things talk about swimming pools and double-decker buses. We haven't had that in this, which I'm glad to see. But.
And is it Buckingham Group doing the earth moving itself, or is it employing a subcontractor or subcontractors to do that?
Good question. I had the impression it was doing it itself, but I'm trying to zoom in on the picture, and the logo on the machines look familiar and don't look like, it's not a high enough resolution picture to see, but it doesn't look like Buckingham. So, no, I suspect they've found it out to someone.
Well, the reason I ask is that if Buckingham is taking on earth-moving contracts of that sort of magnitude, I should really know about it, because I've just published a sector focus on the earth-moving sector, where I've selected what I think are the 20 biggest earth-moving contractors in the UK, and Buckingham isn't on there. So if they are, and they should be on there, then please let me know, and I'll try to make the necessary adjustments. But yeah, that's a massive contract, and there's been a lot of earth-moving work going on in the last couple of years. I mean, I suppose there always is. But I don't know if you see the sector focus in. It was in the March issue of the magazine.
I have it in front of me.
And when I sort of crunch the numbers, basically we take all the latest financial results from the 20 companies that we think are the 20 largest in the country, and we just basically look at them and see how they're all doing. And it's not a particularly optimistic picture that emerges. I mean, sort of overall revenues are down by over 13%. And worse than that, overall pre-tax profits are down almost 31%.
But on the one hand, this is a COVID year.
Yes, it is.
Years. I mean, some go to November 2020 and some go to sort of March 2021.
Yeah.
Or even May 2020, March 2021. So there is a sort of a COVID warning attached to these numbers. However, earth moving was probably the least COVID affected activity, I would have thought, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at the HS2, of course, has been doing an awful lot of earth moving. In fact, we do mention Collins Earthworks, which is number two on our list. Famously, did the massive earth moving job 300,000 cubic meters, which doesn't seem quite as much as Buckingham Group's shifting at the moment, but 300,000 cubic meters of soil for the North Portal site of the Long Itchington Wood Tunnel on HS2. That was their big job for this period of that we're talking about. And Collins doing pretty well, actually. I mean, their turnover's increased by more than 15% over this period, and their pre-tax profits shot up. So yeah, there's a lot of earth moving around, but I think maybe just a few big companies have sort of cornered the market in it, and a lot of other people are sort of finding that times are a bit leaner than that. I mean, whenever we do this sort of analysis of a particular sector, it's always the usual suspects that appear on the table, and usually the same top five each time. So they are, I suppose, the focus is on the ones who are dominating the market inevitably. And so you get companies like MJ Evans, which are number one with a turnover of 136.2 million for the period. I think it was basically most of 2020, doing really nicely, actually. And then others further down the list not doing quite so well. But the fact that even amongst our selection of 20 companies, we're seeing a decline in turnover and in pre-tax profit, I think that sends a message. And we've seen it in other sectors as well. There are very few which haven't actually seen a fall in revenue and profit over the last couple of years, by sector, not by company, of course. And I think that, you know, we've had Brexit, we've had COVID, we've still got COVID, I suppose, and times have been tough. But famously, the construction index seems to have weathered the storm, the COVID storm, at least. We didn't see the devastation that we thought we were going to see in 2020. It's just knocked a bit of a dent into the market, I think. So, yeah. And of course, now we've got inflation and the red diesel situation. People like the earth movers are going to, you know, be squeezed even harder.
Yes, because they absolutely are powered by diesel more than any other sector. I was interested. It's often interesting, these things. I mean, you pulled out the broad trends of the study that you did. I'd quite like to find a bit more about the story. I don't know if you have any detail on this, about the two companies that grew by more than 40% in what is essentially 2020, 2021. VHE.
Oh, yes.
Whose turnover grew from 15 to 21, which is, I mean, that's 40%. Okay, it's perhaps when that's at a level, it doesn't maybe seem that significant, but MJ Church grew from 44 to nearly 64 million.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a 20 million pound growth. But yeah, as I say, nearly 50% growth, 45% growth.
Yeah, that's MJ true, Church. Yeah.
That's quite a leap. Any explanation, any insight into why they had such a bumpy year?
Well, I should.
Is that an HS2?
Well, maybe. No, I don't think they are involved in HS2. I don't have their details in front of me at the moment, so I'm not quite sure about that. They are, as I said, based down in the southwest, and I see their vehicles around an awful lot. They're very dominant. There's a big. Do you remember we talked about that archaeological find on a housing development down in South Devon, in a recent podcast?
The one near Plymouth.
Yes, and I'm trying to remember what it's called, but I can't off the top of my head. Yeah, great big. It's basically a new town they're building there. Well, MJ Church are doing
Sherford.
All the, Sherford, that's the one. Yeah, they found sort of old mammoth bones and stuff like that. Very interesting story. But yeah, Sherford, which actually is a site I've visited. I did write about it few years ago. Very big job, and basically a new town and MJ Church are doing all the earth moving there, but they are definitely the dominant earth moving contractor down in sort of Devon, Cornwall, and probably Dorset. You see them everywhere, and they're growing. There is quite a lot of infrastructure work, I suppose, happening in this part of the world, and they seem to have their finger in every pie. But I mean, they're number three on our list after Collins, and number one, M&J Evans, they are big, and they will get even bigger because they have just taken over Flynn Group, which is a, funnily enough, another Wiltshire-based earth-moving company. They're number four on the list with a turnover of 51 million. So they've been absorbed into M&J Evans. Their headquarters are now up in Walsall as well. So M&J Evans is extending its reach, and I think we're going to see quite a lot from them. They're going to certainly, well, we're seeing a lot from them already. They're number one on the list, but they're going to get even bigger.
But I noticed number 17 on the list by turnover ranking is MJ Hickey.
Yeah.
Now, MJ Hickey, MJ Church, and M&J
Evans.
Yes, I know. So I think that there should be a rule written that no more earth-moving companies should be allowed to use M&J in their names. It's getting out of hand.
Well, yes, I think too many of them are called Michael and Joseph, or Michael and James,
or Mutton Jeff, probably.
Mutton Jeff. Yeah, it is strange, isn't it? I mean, further down the list, I can't see any other M&Js, but I bet they're there. So
certainly, I was just googling while you're talking. MJ Church,
yeah,
the number three on the list, the one down your way you're talking about. See if there was a particular big job that stood out. And it seems that it's sort of busy all over the place, or in the region, it seems. But do you remember we talked a few weeks ago about company strap lines that they use to to describe what they do? And I was quite scathing of some of them, but I like this one. MJ Church, using technology to break new ground.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's good.
It's essentially earth moving is we think of it as being traditionally low tech. It's bucket and spade time. Of course, these days with autonomous machineries and lasers and programmable machines and so on and so forth and onboard weighing systems, this, that and the other, there is an awful lot of tech in there, which is unseen and unappreciated by many. But using technology to break new ground, it does make them sound like a Californian tech company, you know. But of course they're literally breaking ground with technology.
Exactly. So that's the clever bit. Breaking new ground. Yes. Maybe that's a secret to their success. I'm sure you can't attribute it just to their strapline. they're a successful company. Maybe I'll take a closer look at them one of these days and find out what their secret is, apart from being an MJ.
Well, I slightly drifted off topic there, talking about branding and marketing. But it does remind me that a couple of fascinating marketing case studies have come out this week. Nothing to do with construction, but I think anyone who's in business, they do hold lessons. And forgive the tangent, but we loosely gave a passing reference to the horror show that a P&O Ferries last week. And then that prompted P&O Cruises, who these days are a completely separate entity, company.
Okay.
Owned by an American, big American company. No relation whatsoever, except historically they were the same organization.
Yeah.
And therefore they still have the same name. P&O Cruises have had to take out ads everywhere saying, please note that P&O Cruises are not those bad guys who sack people by Zoom message and break employment law to take on agency labour below minimum wage. We're nice people, we're good guys, and we do holidays. And it just sort of showed how your brand name can be trashed by something that's nothing to do with you, by outside forces. And you can't always, you know, you just can't always control what someone's going to do to your brand, even though they're not actually anything to do with you or doing it to you. And there was an even bigger scale brand trashing or brand emergency, I should say, for a big Swiss insurance company whose logo has been adopted by Russian supporters. Yes, Zurich. Their logo on social media is just a big Z. And they've had to rapidly run around social media taking down their big Z, saying, no, we're not sort of Putin supporting pro-Ukrainian war. We're against that. And I don't know what other companies might have a Z in their logo prominently they're having to address, but there won't be any as big as Zurich Insurance.
No.
But again, I just thought this is a fascinating business study, marketing case study, for how your perfectly innocent, literally, brand can be dragged through the mire.
Yeah. Well, there's a lesson. Well, I suppose there's nothing you can really do about that because you can't foresee what might happen. I mean, if
you've just got to respond quickly. That's all you're going to do. I got an interesting press release from Volker Story, the joint venture Volker Rail and Story, who are working on the Hope Valley rail line in Yorkshire. The railway runs between Sheffield and Manchester. And they're building, they've got two bits of it, I think. They're doing a new station somewhere, station improvements. Mm-hmm. And they're also adding a new bit of a 1 kilometre passing loop around Bamford Station so that passenger trains can overtake slower trains. Anyway, and it's a £80 million contract, quite a big deal. And I don't know whether the client is a local, I don't think it's a national rail job. I don't know if it's I actually don't know who the client is. But as we may or may not have talked about in the past, there is a coming. Well, we have talked about it. We talked about rewilding.
Yes.
We had our guest on talk about rewilding. That was last year sometime. And there is a law coming in. It's currently, it's more than good practice. What is it? It's written in the standards.
It's in the Environment Act.
Yes, but I'm trying to think of what the term. It's in the National Planning Policy Framework.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. It's in the sort of the guidelines say that you should seek to when you build anything, you should do something that leaves the planet healthier than when you left, you know, before you came along and stuck steel and concrete in the ground.
Mm.
And Volkastor is saying, yeah, well, you know, we're good citizens of the planet. We've done this on our Hope Valley Rail project, and we've done lots of planting.
Well, this is because the Environment Act 2021 will require, it's not a requirement yet, it's in the Act, and it will come into force next year, will require every development to include, I've got it written down here, it will become a mandatory requirement for development within the next 2 years to build in a 10% environmental biodiversity net gain into every development. And this is part of the, you know, the planning regulations. So basically, if you develop anything, so a railway or a housing development or anything like that, the site of your activity must be 10% richer in biodiversity after you've completed it than it was before you started. Leaving aside how the hell you measure that, and I haven't got any answers for that, I'm afraid.
No, there's a solution. It may not be a good solution, but the answer is PAS. There is, apparently, I don't know if it's complete or in the works, but a publicly accepted specification or something.
Yes, that's right.
PAS,
yes.
Stands for.
Yeah.
It's like what British standards used to be, but modern.
Okay.
So there is, and I think it's the one way, unlike social value that we talked about last week, there is just one way of measuring it.
Yeah.
And it's probably equally spurious and assumptions built into it and hypothetical and, you know, stick your wet finger in the air and see which way the wind blows, but they measure it somehow.
Well, I think, in fact, looking at this story, that Volker Rail is working towards a 12% biodiversity net gain on this particular job.
So they're going above and beyond, as they said, the 10% is not even yet law. And
exactly.
They planted 172 trees, 18,000 whips, which are they like baby trees? I don't know.
I think they're just sort of like bits of willow you stick in the ground and they grow.
Exactly, I think. Right. 18,000 of those, which is a lot. 410 metres of hedges and native species. Mm-hmm. And more than 9,000 square metres of grass. Now, this sounds fantastic. Here's where I got interested in this story. I mean, that's all good positive stuff, which an awful lot of people are doing. And this is a good case study of good people doing good works.
Mm-hmm.
Except they planted all of this stuff at Sickleholm Golf Course. Now, it strikes me that...
Which I'm assuming golf course is alongside the railway, is it?
It is. It's alongside the railway.
That's good.
But a golf course, leaving aside the fact that it's a private members club and, you know, any class prejudices that one might have about golfers or whatever. I mean, forget that nonsense. But the fact is that I'm not sure that the intention of the government making biodiversity net gain a legal requirement, I don't think the intention was that we've got to go around improving golf courses up
No.
around the country. It somehow seems to be missing the spirit of the thing. You'd rather they were planting on an old coal mine or open cast coal field or somewhere a bit crap and derelict was being made beautiful and green and verdant, rather than, you know, the dog leg at the 18th was made a bit tighter.
I agree. I don't think it looks as good as perhaps it's made out to be. But then, if I'm correct, I think that this railway goes through the Peak District National Park. And I imagine the more pristine the environment is before you start, the more difficult it is to actually get your 10% improvement. And
that was my assumption too. So I emailed them and I said, look, this is interesting and I understand the requirement for biodiversity net gain, but a bit curious that the planting took place on a private golf course. Was that because of the constraints of the Peak District National Park, maybe, the sort of tight planning requirements? Or was it maybe that it's already perfect, it cannot be improved upon?
Yeah.
And I got quite a long reply saying how their landscape management plan had to be approved by the Peak District National Park Authority. And as the golf club adjoins the railway and is a local stakeholder that will be disturbed by the scheme, it seemed like fine to us to do it. The golf course provides an excellent opportunity for habitat creation. giving railway land is restricted in size.
Yeah, I just don't.
It it looks like that the golf course is getting a bit of landscaping done for free, by one of its neighbours. I don't know whether they've contributed anything to the cost.
I think, you know, even if it'd been a local authority golf course, maybe it is. I don't think it is, but it just seems. I have this vision now of there's going to be a big unforeseen boom in golf course improvement works because people are looking for nice, easy, you know. Because of course, if you want to plant however many thousands of willows these guys planted, it must be quite hard. There probably isn't always an obvious open field that is ready to be planted out. And maybe a golf course is an easy place to turn to. Maybe other people go, oh, that's a good idea.
I think the whole sort of 10% biodiversity net gain requirement is a real challenge because it applies to all developments. I mean, there's no limit in size or anything like that. We had Stephanie Ray from RSK Wilding, environmental consultant, on the podcast a couple of years ago, as you, I'm sure you'll remember. And she was talking about the whole issue of rewilding, letting land go wild again in order to achieve some sort of biodiversity net gain. And she made the point that in actual fact, if you're building on most developments, you're putting something on it. So she said, if you're building on 80% of the site, which is typically what happens, she says you simply can't make the site 10% richer in habitats and species because, you know, you're covering, you know, to put it bluntly or crudely, you're covering 80% of the site in concrete. So she made the point that, you know, to get your 10% biodiversity net gain, you need to offset. And, you know, we've talked about offsetting and carbon offsetting particularly in the past and how that's questionable in many ways. But what she thinks might happen, and I'm sure this will happen, is that developers will buy up land, you know, sort of derelict land, maybe even contaminated land might make it even more attractive. Not for development so much, but in order to clean it up and achieve their 10% net gain by improving a bit of derelict land, which is no good for anything in particular, but by creating a thriving natural habitat there and by cleaning it up and letting it go wild. So that's one way around it. I suppose
it has to be natural habitat, doesn't it? I can't buy a field and build a zoo on it. And fill it with animals.
I don't think that counts. I mean, I think if it's contaminated, you remove the contaminants, I guess, and then let nature take over. Or sometimes you can clean up the ground by letting nature do the work, can't you? I mean, there are certain plants you can plant that actually absorb heavy metals and stuff like that and take them out of the ground. So that's an option. Rewilding is an option. But I suppose a handy golf course, which needs a bit of, you know, a clump of trees here or a few shrubs there or a length of hedge along a boundary would be another convenient way of achieving your 10%.
But the opposite end of whether it's rewilding or improving golf courses, there's been quite a growth on the market of building products like nesting boxes, which are bricks, or bat boxes.
That's right,
little ready-made, not quite cat flaps, but holes you can put in fences and walls and things.
Yeah.
That are for small creatures to be able to get from one garden to the next. And so it's building animal-friendly features into the actual fabric of what you're constructing, which I guess you're adding to the biodiversity. So I guess that's, it can't be a gain, I don't think, having one brick which does that, which a swallow can nest in.
But a lot of developments have done this for many years, you know, roads with sort of badger bridges or tunnels and hedgehog tunnels and that kind of thing. And I can remember locally when they were building the ring road around Barnstable, there was a new road put in, which they found out was on a foraging route for greater horseshoe bats or long-eared bats, I can't remember, but bats anyway. And we all know that bats need to be protected. And the new structure that they were putting here was actually on the flight path. They'd actually mapped the foraging flight path of these bats, and they realized that if they put this flyover or bridge or whatever it was there, it was going to interrupt this flight path. So they actually made little tunnels in it so that the bats could fly through and continue their habitual foraging routes. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that's been done for many years. I think now it's just...
Hold it. I'm all for saving bats, but why can't they fly over or under?
I can't remember. I can't even remember which part of the project
it
was.
And if bats fly at a very specific elevation, why not make the bridge a bit higher then so that they just...
More expensive, I suppose. More expensive. I can't remember the details, but I do remember being quite impressed by the fact they'd taken that into account.
I agree. Sounds over-engineered to me, though.
Yeah.
They might have taken into account at the last minute. Damn, we forgot the bats. Quick, get the drill out.
Possibly. I'm sure that happens all the time. But I should also say, to plug the magazine once more, on the next page, after our sector focus on the earth-moving industry, we've got our lowdown feature, which is actually on the Environment Act 2021. So you can read all about biodiversity net gain and all the other provisions of the new Act on those two pages as well. That was written for us by Alex Minnett at Chas. So, yeah, that's worth a read as well.
That was well planned, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
But going back to the Hope Valley Rail Line tree planting, there was something else, I think, that caught your eye about it, wasn't there?
It was the... Well, there were a lot of people, the photographs, obviously the first thing you see, the photographs, there were an awful lot of people out on that golf course planting these saplings and whips and various things. And they're all, you know, standing out in the middle of a golf course, togged out from head to toe in PPE. So there's the bright orange high-vis overalls, jackets, trousers, the boots and everything, the hard hats, the gloves. Eye protection? Can't spot any eye protection, but I bet it's there.
It's hard to tell whether it's eye protection or just sunnies. I think they're eye protection. And in fact, the guy in the foreground looks like he's got ear defenders in, little earplugs in, but he might be listening to the radio.
That's true. Yeah, those might be his AirPods. But it did look like PPE overkill to me. You know, health and safety gone mad, all the rest of it.
For tree planting? Okay,
yeah.
Right, do you need a high-vis and a hard hat for planting trees? Is that a requirement?
Well, I think if there's a camera nearby, yes, it is. Because, I mean, all sorts of unspeakable things happen on sites when nobody's pointing a camera at them. But the minute somebody whips out a camera, it's, you can't do that. And they have to stop work and everybody rush off and put their hard hats on. As you will have discovered yourself many times that, you know, you get sent a press release and then you get a follow-up press release saying, please don't use the photograph. Because it's...
Someone didn't have a hard hat on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the fact that they should have had a hard hat on in the first place and had neglected to wear it is not the problem from the marketing department's point of view. It's the fact that it doesn't look good.
And I've worked on magazines where we've had stroppy phone calls from whether it be readers or the parties concerned saying, how dare you print that photograph which shows someone not wearing a hard hat?
Yeah.
You should not be publishing that. And I go... Have a word with the guy who wasn't, you know, have a guy with a word with the site manager who, I'll give you his phone number, you can call them, complain to them about
the person
not wearing the hard hat. Wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
I said, no, you shouldn't be publicising bad practice. So let's not have any photos of the war in Ukraine, folks.
Well, no, indeed.
It's a bad thing, so we shouldn't see it.
Anyway.
Well, I think that's a wrap for this week then, David.
I think it probably is.
Did you realise that next week will be our 100th episode?
Oh, I wonder why I was feeling so tired.
We've done 99 reconstructions and next week's 100.
Wow.
We don't yet know really what we're going to talk about, because we never know what we're going to talk about on the whole from one week to the next. But if you have any suggestions... please let us know, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. If you are a regular listener, and I believe we have at least three of them, do get in touch and share with us some of your thoughts about where we've been going wrong, where we've been going right. Tell us some of the things that you might have agreed with or disagreed with that we've been saying over the past 2 years now, and give us a steer. We are very flexible and open to be pointed in the right direction. So podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Do get in touch. It would be great to hear from you. And we haven't done the please subscribe call out for a long time. So please subscribe at whatever podcast service you use. And if there is a provision for you to leave a review, like what there is on Apple podcasty things, give us however many stars you think we deserve and leave a comment, by all means. And other than that, David, anything to add?
I don't think so, except I'd like to say thank you to our sponsor, as always. It's nice to know that somebody's prepared to back us up, as you say, and thank you to our listeners, all three of them. And, we look forward to the 100th episode next week.
So from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.